Hey guys, just a quick note up top that we love having great advertisers on the show. You guys being so supportive of them is one of the reasons this show gets made every week. But in order to continue having great advertisers, we need a little bit of your help. All we need is for you to go to podsurvey.com/crack to take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you guys just a little better. This way we can pair our show with the best advertisers, the podcast can continue running, and you guys can hear about sweet deals and awesome products that are actually relevant to your lives. If you've taken our listener survey before, this one's brand new and different, so you can feel free to take it again. We'll let you. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. So, yeah, help us out a little bit and maybe get a free Amazon gift card along the way by going to podsurvey.com/cracked. That's podsurvey.com/CRACKED. What does it take to be a real schmuck, just a grade-A asshole? Filmmaker and comedian Jesse Kahnwieler is going to find out by interviewing some of the most hated people on the internet, including tech bro Martin Shkreli and the woman behind the Dear Fat People video. Man, they were not kidding. Those are bad people. So yeah, hear how Jesse tracks down these notorious characters and what they have to say for themselves in her new show, Schmucks. To find out more and hear the trailer, go to stitcherpremium.com/schmucks. That's stitcherpremium.com/SCHMUCKS.
Listen up, everybody, the bottom line. I'm a black intellect, but I'm refined. Precision like the bullet, target bound. Just living like a hookup, the harlot sounds. Now, when I say the harlot, you know I need the hot. Heat of the equator, the broth that's in the pot. Jalik, jalik, you wind up your hip.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm editor in chief of Cracked. And before I tell you what this week's song is and why we're listening to it, real quick, I want to tell you that Saturday, March 11th at 7 p.m. is our next live show. It's spring break. Woo, spring break. We're talking about the best fictional vacations, Amity Island, Jurassic World, Jurassic Park. Most vacation movies are about things going disastrously, horribly wrong, Titanic. So it should be interesting to see what movie our hilarious comedian guests decide to visit. Tickets are $7, and we'll link to a page where you can buy them in the description on iTunes. All right, and this week we're listening to Oh My God off a Tribe Called Quest's album, Midnight Marauders, featuring Busta Rhymes on the hook. Just a great beat. But it's appropriate we're listening to a song with God in the hook, because this week's episode is about some of the biggest lies that most of us believe about religions, specifically other people's religions, which I think most of us tend to regard as one of the least interesting subjects to discuss, to the point that it's kind of a cliche, like on the list of iconic people you don't want to find on your porch after your doorbell rings. I think Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and other religious evangelists are somewhere below guy serving you papers and slightly above guy in uniform standing solemnly with his hat in his hand, prepared to tell you that a loved one is dead. Yeah, it doesn't matter how laid back the youth group pastor is. Nobody who's not already on board wants to hear the good news about this dude JC and his totally chill posse of 12 homies. But as a result of that natural instinct to run away from people who want to talk to you about their religion, most of us go through life never really understanding the dominant narrative frameworks that most of the members of our species kind of see their lives as existing within. You may be more open-minded than me, I guess, but I can say, for instance, that my knowledge of most of the world's religions was relegated to maybe one or two basic cartoonish facts that I have since come to learn either aren't important to what those faiths believe or aren't even accurate. The one thing I knew about the Amish is that they don't use technology or electricity, which not true. Lots of Amish people have washing machines and cell phones. They just don't like to be suckling at the teat of big electricity. So they use gasoline generators and windmills to live off the public grid, it turns out. Growing up, one of the few facts I knew about Judaism was, one, that the Star of David was their kind of official bat signal, their version of the Christian cross, and also that sometimes they had sex through a hole in a sheet, neither of which is true. The sex thing is apparently based on anti-Semitic Christians seeing their Jewish neighbors drying a cloak with a hole for, you know, the neck of a human head and assuming it was a weird sex thing, as we're wont to do as repressed Christians. And the Star of David's association with the Jewish faith stretches all the way back to the 19th century, which I'm told the Jewish faith is older than that. And this is just the stuff I was wrong about that we don't get to in this episode's conversation with Reza Aslan. He and I are going to talk about some other lies you probably believe about the major religions of the world, because even if you're a religious person, you know, the most common religion, which is Christianity, only makes up 31.5% of the global population. So most of the world is made up of other people's religions for literally everyone. And if you're a non-religious person, as so many of us increasingly are, I feel like it's even easier to dismiss the beliefs of billions of people with the wave of a hand, because cynicism's fun and sort of easy to confuse with intelligence. We've been talking a lot about Bill Maher on this week's editorial meeting because of his bizarrely friendly interview with that Nazi pedophile Milo guy. And it reminded me about his documentary that he made a few years back called Religulous. Supposed to be religious and ridiculous combined. And as that brilliant title might suggest, it's about how patently absurd religion is. And one of the scenes, he goes up to people visiting a Christian holy site and just like reels off all these historical facts, like that the BC years are full of Messiah figures who are also born of a virgin, baptized in a river. And the implication is obviously supposed to be that Jesus was just, you know, this fictional character that was grafted over a bunch of myths that societies of the past already had. There's also a long slideshow in that same section where we learn that the Egyptian Book of the Dead describes a god named Horus, who is the son of God, born to a virgin, baptized in a river by Anup the baptizer, who was later beheaded. Like Jesus, he's tempted while alone in the desert. He heals the sick, the blind, casts out demons, walks on water. He raised Asar from the dead, and Asar translates to Lazarus, had 12 disciples, was crucified, and after 3 days, two women announced Horus, the savior of humanity, had been resurrected. So yeah, Bill Maher's standing there just rattling off these facts, and he looks so smart and confident, and the religious people are like, well, you believe what you want to believe, Bill. I'll believe the word of God. And obviously, when we see that, we're supposed to. And when I first saw it, I did kind of despair for the future of humanity and those people who don't understand the difference between historical fact and, you know, what they personally believe. Except every single one of those facts that Bill Maher quotes in that section is wrong. And not from a, you know, everything in the Bible is true and history is wrong perspective. From a scholarly academic perspective, everything Bill Maher says is wrong. The world that he's supposed to be representing, he's wrong by those standards. All those interpretations of the Egyptian Book of the Dead are taken from an amateur Egyptologist who actual professional scholars all agree was wrong and just kind of had an axe to grind. So yeah, Bill Maher traveled around the world to visit a Christian holy land and pick a fight with people who had themselves traveled there to practice their faith. And he has to use made up facts to make his point. Kind of makes you wonder why he'd need to make up facts if religion and spirituality is so laughably easy to debunk, as his movie claims. Anyways, I don't think there's a wrong answer in any of this other than to intentionally mislead people, or as we'll discuss, to find any of it boring. I hope you find this conversation as interesting as I did. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. One for the trouble, two for the bass. You know the style tip, it's time to flip this. I like my beats hard like two-day old shit. Steady eating booty MCs like cheesecakes. My man, I'll be sure he's in effect mode. To have a crush on doing for men vote. It's not like Honey Dick will want to get with me, but just in case I own my condom, then see your seat. Now the formula is this, me tipping Ali. So I am joined by Reza Aslan, who is the host of a new CNN show, Believer, and is also a best-selling author and a scholar of religions, who's written a bunch of really interesting books. Thank you for joining us, Reza.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the podcast, guys.
He's also the star of a viral video you might have seen about 3 years ago when you went on Fox News and they kept asking you how you could write a book about Jesus if you are Islamic. And you just had to explain patiently why that was the stupidest and most offensive question ever.
This is an interesting book. Now, I want to clarify, you're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity?
Well, to be clear, I am a scholar of religions with 4 degrees, including one in the New Testament and fluency in biblical Greek, who has been studying the origins of Christianity for 2 decades, who also just happens to be a Muslim. So it's not that I'm just some Muslim writing about Jesus. I am an expert with a PhD in the history of religions. But I have been obsessed
question,
with Jesus.
Though, it still begs the question, why would you be interested in the founder of Christianity?
Because it's my job as an academic. I am a professor of religion, including the New Testament.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's going to be on my gravestone.
So not the worst thing. You handled yourself very well in the face of some pretty staggering stupidity and laziness, just general laziness of thought.
Well, listen, I learned a long time ago that when you're a brown man on TV, you need to keep calm. No matter what, just keep calm.
You certainly did that. I read some of Zealot last night and was just kind of looking at the trailer and some of the material on Believer. And the trailer for Believer has an interesting moment where you're talking about a guy who is kind of spinning around in a room claiming he's the Messiah. And with 100% conviction, there's nothing that seems fake or like calculating about it. It seems like this person genuinely believes he's the Messiah. And I think you say something to the effect of either he's the Messiah or he's completely batshit crazy. You probably don't use those words on CNN, but, and then you said, and there's no reason it can't be both. Can you talk a little bit about that idea?
As a matter of fact, batshit crazy is exactly the term that I use. Yeah, look, I mean, in many ways, I think I'm glad that you brought that up, because in many ways, that phrase basically sums up the entire thesis of the show, which is that, you know, belief comes in many different forms. And it is often the case where we just kind of assume that people who hold somewhat extraordinary beliefs are, you know, insane or not worth paying attention to. But then when we are confronted with our own beliefs, we just assume that ours are somehow rational. You know, that's one great experience of it. So here's this man, his name is Jesus with a Z. That's right, Jesus with a Z. He does believe that he is the Messiah. He does have a prophecy about the impending doom of the planet as a result of climate change, which is not that crazy, frankly. Right. And he has put together this community of fellow believers who, you know, you walk into this compound and the whole time you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, like this is a doomsday cult. Like this is like Jonestown. This is like David Koresh level stuff. And then you live among these guys for, you know, 7, 8, 9 days, and you realize, they're not that weird, and they're not that bizarre, and what they believe isn't all that crazy if you really think about it. In many ways, that, I hope, is going to be the experience of the viewers to every one of these episodes. You know, you're going to watch it and you're going to think to yourself, probably at first, this shit is crazy. Like, that is insane. This is about as foreign and exotic and unfamiliar as it gets. And then as the hour rolls on and you are kind of going through the journey with me, you'll probably end the hour by thinking to yourself, oh, okay, not as weird as I thought. And maybe I actually believe some of that myself, though I probably express it in a different way. If I can get the viewer to go through that sort of journey with me, then I will be ecstatic.
There's a video featuring you on CNN that is Reza Aslan explains cults. And you basically say cults plus time equals religion. That all religions are start out as cults. All a cult is a set of beliefs that seem weird to people because they're generally new.
That's it, right there. Yeah. You hit it on the head.
What is it about Hawaii that seems to draw cults? Because there's that Holy Hell cult that they made a documentary about recently, and I think the Branch Davidians spent some time in Hawaii too. I guess
we actually talked about this a lot in the. Yeah, in the episode, the second episode, which is the episode in which I hang out with this doomsday group in Hawaii, we actually talk a lot about what is it with Hawaii? Like, what is it in the soil here that draws these different groups together? Hawaii, I've gone to Hawaii for many, many years. It's a place of deep spiritual connection for me. And I think it's partly just because there is truly something in the soil that allows for this kind of religious experimentation, you know? When you're in Hawaii, especially the Big Island, which is where this particular community is, you can't help but feel, like, attuned with nature and the spirits. I mean, it's everywhere around you. And so I think that there's something there that kind of fosters this kind of, I mean, look, if you're thinking of starting your own cult, Hawaii is not a bad place. There's something about it that draws people to it. But to your larger point about this notion of, you know, cult plus time equals religion, that's really true. It's part of the reason why I think a lot of religion scholars just don't use the word cult anymore, because basically cult has just come to mean a value judgment. You just call whatever religion you disagree with a cult. I mean, Christianity, the Roman Empire called Christianity a cult for 300 years, and then it was swallowed up by Christianity, you know, so therefore no longer a cult. To this day, a great many Americans still refer to Mormonism as a cult, despite the fact that this is a 200-year-old religion that's global, that's expanding, it's in every corner of the world, and yet people still refer to it in that way. Scientology, which is one of the episodes that we do, right? Scientology, I think most people would say, well, Scientology is not really a religion, it's a cult. And my response to that is, I'm an expert on religion, and I can't tell you the difference between a cult and a religion. So, you know, I just call it a religion and move on. People wishing for a burner to kill everybody walking. You know that it's on the furnace, but bitch, you beat you. How they want you, fucking no beat you, but if you wallet, kill everybody walking. You know that it's on the furnace. Timmy Turner.
Hey guys, we're listening to Timmy Turner by Designer, the guy who brought us Panda, which was featured in Father Stretch My Hands Part 2 by Kanye West. This song actually started as an a cappella riff he did for some XXL Rookie of the Year feature or something, and people liked it so much they turned it into a song, and there's something kind of mournful and almost religious-y about the tone of the chorus and the sample, and the lyrics are about his soul being cast down into a furnace. They're also about Timmy Turner, the character from Fairly Odd Parents, getting a burner and shooting a bunch of people and having sex with a woman who wants to get on BET. But no reason all the crazy shit can't be about God, too. Anyways, hope you enjoy it and enjoy these words from our sponsors. Yeah. This episode of the Crack Podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, the best place to go if you're hiring and want to find the best candidates all in one place. Also, here's a hot tip if you're looking for a job. It's one of the best places to post your resume and get hired. ZipRecruiter puts over 200 job sites all in one easy-to-use dashboard, so when the candidates start coming in, they're all in one place, and you can easily screen them, rate them, and hire the right person pretty fast. So find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses, and I didn't even know there were 1 million businesses. That's impressive, ZipRecruiter. It's also been featured in Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. I've heard of all of those. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/cracked. That's ZipRecruiter.com/cracked to start posting your job for free. Today's episode of the Crack Podcast is also sponsored by our good friends at Blue Apron. Listen, not all ingredients are created equal. All people? Yes, I agree with that sentiment. Not all ingredients, though. And you know that if you've gone to the nice butcher in town or picked up veggies from the farmer's market. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, which is why it's important to know where your food comes from. Thankfully, for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers easy-to-follow recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients. And they do it using over 150 local farms, ranches, and fisheries across the United States. Some of the meals they have prepared for this month include cashew chicken stir-fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. That was all one meal, and my mouth is watering now. They also have udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs, which sounds delish. I've used Blue Apron before at my home, and my wife and I loved it. It's a great experience. You guys feel like you've done something together because you have. Everyone gets involved, sort of shares in the success of it looking and tasting good. So check out this week's menu, and they're going to give you your first three meals free with free shipping if you go to blueapron.com/cracked. Trust me, you're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Again, that's blueapron.com/cracked. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Hard to tell you that some religion that isn't a huge deal right now would become like the next Islam or the next Christianity like 500 years from now. Would you find that offensive, first of all? And second of all, would you have like a guess as to which religion you think has the best prospects to kind of become a future globe-dominating religion?
That's a great question. And no, of course not. I'm not even remotely offended by it. I'm fascinated by it. I mean, you know, like, these are the questions that I live for. So let me say, so first of all, I think that we have that religion here. I mean, people don't understand what a fringe religion Mormonism was less than 100 years ago. I mean, when we passed a law in the United States outlawing polygamy, that was specifically because of Mormonism. Like, we did that in order to attack Mormonism as a religion. It's not like we have always outlawed polygamy in America. It was just, we're doing it just to attack this one religion. That's how fringe it was. Today, I mean, it's a beautiful, global religion that exists in almost every corner of the world. And that's an American story, because Mormonism, whatever else it is a distinctly American religion. It essentially rewrites the gospel narrative, but in an American context. For those of your listeners who are unfamiliar with what I'm talking about, at the core of Mormon mythology is the notion that Jesus Christ, after he was crucified and put into a tomb, appeared in the United States and essentially preached, you know, the gospel message to Native Americans. And then many, many, many years later, that teaching was rediscovered by Joseph Smith, and therefore everything that we know about Mormonism. Now, you may hear that and you may think to yourself, well, that sounds kind of insane, like that doesn't make any sense. But does it make less sense than God took some dirt and blew in it and made a man, and then took that man's rib and made of woman, and then the two of them populated the planet as we know it. Does it? Does it really?
Yeah.
Not really. What's the difference? One is 5,000 years old, and one is about 150, 160 years old. That's the difference. And so I do think that, like, if I were to look ahead 300 years, I think Mormonism is going to be a major global religion. I mean, it depends on how the Scientology Reformation goes, but the same thing might happen to Scientology. I think Scientology is in a very interesting moment right now because it has to make a decision whether it's going to try to continue to maintain an iron-fisted control over the religion, because if it does, it probably won't exist 100 years from now. Or is it going to, like the Catholic Church did, eventually give up that control and allow it to grow organically among individuals? If it does, then who knows? A couple of hundred years from now, Scientology might be a major global religion. I do think that one religion in particular that I am just absolutely fascinated by, and it's one that we actually profile in the show, is called Santa Muerte.
Yes.
And this is a distinctly Mexican folk religion. It marries traditional Mexican Aztec religiosity with Catholicism to create something brand new. Santa Muerte, of course, is Spanish for Saint Death. And for those of your listeners who may be unfamiliar with this, I bet you know what I'm talking about. Because if you have walked through the streets of Los Angeles or, you know, New Mexico or really any of the southern states, and you have seen in some Latin community or some Latin neighborhood an image of a skeleton wearing a dress, that's Santa Muerte. And that religion is not even, it's maybe 50 years old. And already it has something anywhere between 8 to 10 million adherents. Now, those adherents are primarily in Mexico and in Latin America, but the more we have, like, migration from these countries into the West, the more the religion is coming with them. I live in Los Angeles. If I go down, like, Olvera Street, it'd be sort of predominantly Mexican or Latino neighborhood, I see Santa Muerte everywhere. There are actually two Santa Muerte temples in Los Angeles. So who knows? You know, depending on migration patterns, Santa Muerte, you know, a barely 50-year-old religion, might in 200-300 years become a global religion.
Hey guys, really quickly off that question of what religion will take over the globe, I think it's fun to kind of think about religion as like an organism with various adaptations that make it better or worse at survival. I think I started thinking about this when I noticed that having a definitive date that the world is going to end is like the junk food of apocalyptic cults. It's good to get you a quick boost of energy and attention, but doesn't last long because at a certain point your date comes to pass and then you're just standing there looking pretty embarrassed. But anyways, yeah, that's what religions are. This is basically the concept that Richard Dawkins created when he described memes for the first time. Religions are memes in the sense that they're self-replicating ideas that have the goal of being recreated over and over by getting passed from one person's mind to the other. And yeah, I just love thinking about what makes a religion good at reproducing and spreading. Like, I've always thought that one of the features that helped Christianity survive across millennia is that it promotes socially agreeable behaviors that are unlikely to make people want to kill you. Like, it just teaches you to react to being punched by turning your cheek and letting them punch the other side of your face. That's not going to piss anybody off. Same for Islam, as it's interpreted by the vast majority of the people on the globe. Another important feature of Christianity and Islam is that they both recruit, and you can be converted to them. Judaism has kind of stayed about the same size for years because they don't really recruit or go out of their way to encourage people to convert. Meanwhile, the fastest growing religion, and Reza's answer for what religion will be a global power in 500 years, Mormonism, recruits like a motherfucker. They stop everything they're doing to go on a mission just to do that, just to recruit people. It encourages peaceful behaviors and like just solid citizenship. And on top of all those things, it encourages you to have lots of kids. So that's like the trifecta that is going to make your religion take off. Anyways, back to the show.
Is it true that Santa Muerte has some roots in like narco cultura, that there was like a narco guy who helped build the religion out, or am I getting that wrong?
Well, you're right in the sense that Santa Muerte, Saint Death, has been adopted by narcos in Mexico as their sort of patron saint. I mean, essentially, this is a worshiping of death, but it's a worshiping of death as a celebration of life. At the same time, because it is a kind of, it's a form of Catholicism. Think of just sort of Catholicism, but with an extra saint. Now, obviously, the Catholic Church says this is not Catholicism. These are devil worshipers. You know, you can't worship death. Christ conquered death. So not only is this devil worship, but it's anti-Christ. And Muerte devotees, for the most part, will say, no, it's not. I mean, this is just, you know, our expression of our Catholic identity. However, because the Catholic Church has essentially disavowed it, what's happened with Santa Muerte is that the people who are on the fringes of society, the people who would say that they were rejected by the church, have flocked to Santa Muerte. So it's a religion that has prostitutes and huge LGBT community involved in Santa Muerte, but also gangs and criminals and narcos, right? These people who can't really walk into a church on a Sunday morning, but who are seeking some kind of spirituality. And so they flock to Santa Muerte, but so do little old ladies and grandmas. You know, what devotees of Santa Muerte say is that death plays no favorites, right? In the face of death, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're a prostitute or a saint. It doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. It doesn't matter if you're a criminal or, you know, a police officer. We are all the same in the face of death. Santa Muerte accepts everyone. So that has led, of course, to, you know, a lot of these narco gangs being devotees of Santa Muerte and doing terrible things, obviously. But that has then given Santa Muerte this impression for outsiders. And while it is true that it's a religion that a lot of narcos gravitate towards, it's a religion for everybody. It's everybody who feels as though they have been rejected by society. Santa Muerte accepts them.
Yeah, you hang out with, this is a thing I didn't even realize exists, a Scientology reformation with a sort of an independent punk rock strain of Scientologist. That's interesting.
Crazy, right?
Yeah, I had no idea.
Exactly. I think most people, when they think of Scientology, think of the Church of Scientology and, of course, everything that comes along with that, right? The scandals and the corruption and the controversies, everything that we're all pretty much familiar with already. And what's astonishing is that there are thousands of Scientologists who have broken away from the church precisely for those very reasons and who believe that they're the true Scientologists. And it's like very much like what happened in the Christian Reformation, right? Christians saying, well, the church no longer represents the true teachings of Christ. And so, you know, we need to take this into our own hands and separate ourselves from the institution, but not the religion. And that's exactly what these Scientologists say. They're like, the church has essentially bastardized L. Ron Hubbard's teachings. We are the true Scientologists, and we're going to reform this religion. And in the same thing that happened, you know, with the Protestants that came out of the Christian Reformation, these Scientologists who have divorced themselves from the church but not the religion have come up with like a dozen different ways of doing Scientology now, you know? And it's like, it's so fascinating to me, you know, to watch this process take place before our very eyes. And you're right that you say that you've never heard about it. I bet nobody really knows about this.
Yeah, I tried to do some research on it, and it seems like most of the writing and in-depth journalism that's been done has just focused on David Miscavige, the head of the church, and, you know, Tom Cruise, because
That's the more flashy side. And it is really bizarre flavors of corruption that exist in the church.
There's no question that that stuff is fascinating. That's why, like, people, you know, swallow it up.
Totally.
But what I wanted to do in our Scientology episode is answer a completely different question, which is, what exactly is Scientology? You know, whatever TV shows you watch or whatever, you know, behind the scenes of Scientology or Scientology Exposed videos, like, I bet you if I, like, just grab 10 random people on the street, they could all tell me about, you know, various Scientology controversies and stories of corruption and all that stuff, all of which are true, but not a single one of them would be able to answer the question, what actually is Scientology? What do Scientologists actually believe? What do they actually do? And so, I mean, in many ways, like, I think we're the very first program to actually answer that question.
We had an interview at one point on our site with somebody who went to a Scientology center and just said, hey, I'm a Scientologist and I'm here for church or whatever their service is called, and went through the process. And I was surprised that they even had a service. And, like, I just assumed it was all people cleaning Tom Cruise's car and, you know, concentrating on, like, weird machines that they hooked up to their thumbs. But yeah, they had an actual service where they preached the L. Ron Hubbard Bible.
Well, and Going Clear, again, is a show about the church. Our Scientology episode is a show not about the church, but about the religion. And what's funny is I think most people, if you're talking about any other religion, can make that distinction, right? I mean, look, when the Catholic Church was consumed by the pedophilia crisis, right, thousands and thousands of cases of pedophilia over the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, most thinking people were able to say, well, of course there's a difference between the church and, you know, the little old lady who goes to Mass on Sundays. I mean, obviously there's a difference between those two. Like, you can condemn one, but, like, understand the other. You know, most people, when confronted with the violence taking place in the name of Islam, thinking people, as opposed to, for instance, our president, can make a distinction between, oh, well, there's a difference, obviously, between, you know, these, like, institutions or whatever that promote violence and, you know, the normal Muslim who, like, goes to mosque and tries to take care of, you know, his or her family. But I find it amazing that when it comes to Scientology, we can't make that distinction, that there is no distinction between the church and the religion. And so, therefore, the sins of the church, which are very real sins, fall on the religion and anyone who dares believe in it. And I think that that's something that I want to challenge. I want people to think differently. I mean, again, I want them to feel sort of like, right, there is a difference between the church, the institution, and the believers.
Right.
Which is why this show is called Believer. This show is not called religion. It's called Believer, because I'm interested in the people who believe, not in the institutions that, you know, establish and think that they control belief.
Yeah, you mentioned briefly certain misconceptions about Islam, and that's something you've written a lot about. And one of our most popular articles in the history of the site is actually 5 Ridiculous Things You Probably Believe About Islam. And, you know, talks about the fact that not all women have to wear the veil and that a bunch of majority Muslim nations have had more female leaders than we have, which is something I think you brought up in your Fox News interview. Some misconceptions that Muslim equals Arab, which I think seems to be the way it gets treated in the press in America. And just that Western culture is far more humane than that culture is sort of the idea you get, even from Aladdin suggests that it's just this barbaric culture. And just the idea that Islam is stuck in the dark ages. And we all, when I say we, I guess I'm speaking of Americans who got a public school education like me, learned so much about the Italian Renaissance, but we didn't learn anything about all of the amazing contributions and what's arguably an even more impressive renaissance in Muslim nations, the Islamic Golden Age, I think is what it's called, where they invented algebra and other, you know, minor things.
Yeah, like preserve all of the Greek material that we now think of as giving birth to Western civilization. Like, the only reason we know anything about Aristotle or Plato is because it was translated into Arabic. That's why. No, I think that's really true. I will say that, to me, the single greatest misconception about Islam, the thing that, like, people get wrong the most, it's just simply that there's something unusual or different or extraordinary or exceptional about it. It's funny to me that people talk about Islam in a way that they don't talk about any other religion. Nobody in their right mind would think that the world's 2 billion Christians all think the same way, that they all read the scriptures in the same way, that they all believe the same version of Christianity. I mean, that's just idiotic. Like, who thinks that? Nobody with a brain would say that. Nobody with a brain would say, well, all Jews believe exactly the same thing. All Jews follow the Torah in exactly the same way. That's just idiotic. Nobody with a brain would say that. And yet those exact same people wouldn't blink to say, well, yeah, all Muslims feel the same way. All Muslims believe the same thing. All Muslims, you know, read the Quran in the exact same way, that Islam is somehow monolithic in a way that, you know, no other religion in the history of the world is, or that Islam is different, right? Sure, I'll accept the fact that other religions like Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism are diverse and come in many different flavors, that they have all been influenced by history and by culture and by the art. But no, not Islam. Islam is static and monolithic. It doesn't change. It never has changed. It comes in one flavor. It's extraordinary that people who were otherwise smart individuals think that way about Islam. Here's the biggest misconception about Islam. There's nothing unusual about it. There's nothing extraordinary about it. Nothing exceptional about it. It's a religion like any other religion. The Muslims have the same relationship to their religion that Jews or Christians or Buddhists or Hindus have to their religion. The same global forces that have created diversity in all the other great religions of the world have created diversity in Islam. The same cultural forces that have created a Christianity that's different in Latin America than it is in South Korea, than it is in North Africa, than it is in the United States, have also done the same thing with Islam. In fact, if anything, I would go farther and say that Islam is probably the most diverse, the most eclectic religion in the world, because you're talking about a religion of 1.7 billion people without a center. I mean, at least in Catholicism, those 1.2 billion, you know, Catholics in the world, they have a center, right? I mean, there is a Pope who nominally speaks for everyone. There is a Vatican that essentially is in charge of Catholic beliefs and ideas. That doesn't exist in Islam. There's no Muslim Pope. There's no Muslim Vatican. And so that has allowed this massive religion, 1.7 billion people, to evolve organically into, you know, 1,000 different forms.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It seems like there's sort of a pattern where other people's religions, we will just take the worst thing being done in the name of that religion and just be like, that's everyone in that religion. It kind of speaks to, I guess, a certain amount of insecurity about our own, or I don't know.
It's just, you know, it's not just about religion. It's about identity. I think that that's how we are, right? America, right or wrong, we can't do any wrong. It's the rest of the world that's screwed up. You brought it up earlier in a really nice way that, you know, we constantly talk about the lack of women's rights in Islamic countries. And it's certainly true that particularly countries like Saudi Arabia or Iran, you know, have abysmal women's rights records. That said, nine times, Muslim majority countries have elected a female head of state. How many times have we done it?
I think zero.
Yeah, zero, exactly. Zero times. So, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And I think, you know, human beings, we're just, you know, we're tribal people. That's how we are, right? My tribe is the right tribe. Your tribe is wrong. And whether it's religion or whether it's race or whether it's ethnicity or whether it's culture or whether it's nationality, we'll always figure out some way to create an in and out group because it's how we define ourselves, right? It's really hard sometimes to say what you are, but it's really easy to say what you're not. And so what we do when we try to define ourselves is we find someone to define ourselves against.
It's interesting we were talking about Honolulu as a place that sort of inspires a certain spirituality. So I was reading your book Zealot last night, which is sort of a historical take on Jesus of Nazareth's life and sort of looking at the actual historical evidence and interpreting the actual historical evidence. And you have like all sorts of PhDs in this stuff. Like it's so you're not just like going on opinion for anybody who hasn't seen the Fox News interview. So one of the really interesting things that I found out that I didn't know was that Jerusalem and just Jesus's time in general and the years around his life was absolutely full of prophets and like people proclaiming themselves to be a Messiah or a prophet, or that very similar messages to what Jesus ended up going with.
Sometimes almost identical. And in fact, I think that's so important, you know. I mean, this is a book that puts Jesus in the context of his time and place. And his time and place was awash in messianism and apocalyptic expectation. There were hundreds of people walking around saying, I'm the Messiah, I'm the prophet. There were actually many, many people walking around casting out demons and healing the sick, just like Jesus did. It's interesting that we, 2,000 years removed from that time, read the Bible and we hear about Jesus curing someone who was demon-possessed or giving somebody sight or helping a lame person walk. And we're like, oh my gosh, that's extraordinary that he was able to do this, that that's what makes Jesus unique. No, not really. Actually, the wandering miracle worker was actually a pretty common sight. I mean, in fact, it was a very well-paid position. Remember, there were no such thing as doctors at that time. So these wandering miracle workers, these wandering exorcists, would get paid a ton of money to heal the sick, to heal the blind, and, you know, to cast out demons. And Jesus was just one of these people. But there is something that made Jesus extraordinary, and it's in the Bible. It's just that we ignore it because our context is different. What made Jesus extraordinary wasn't that he was performing miracles and casting out demons. What made Jesus extraordinary is that he was doing those things for free, that he wasn't charging for it. And it's right there in the scripture, you know. He walks into a town, and all the poor people come to him because a free healer has showed up. So what does that mean? How does that make us rethink who Jesus was and what Jesus' message was? If what's extraordinary about him isn't his miracles, it's that he was passing them out for free. That's what's extraordinary. It changes the way that we think about him, and hopefully it even changes the way that we even think about his message.
I could hear a marketing executive being like, oh, that's brilliant. Authenticity, that always lends to viral marketing, you know? But that's super interesting. I feel like that's a misconception I've seen in myself and we've kind of uncovered in writing about history. Just that everybody in history was like somewhat simple, or like everything was like a new idea to them. And we don't really build room for the complexity of things. It's interesting that he lived at a time when there were all sorts of messiahs and people walking around, because there's an actual recognized mental disorder called Jerusalem syndrome, where people will travel to Jerusalem, like the Holy Land, and will find themselves hearing voices and suddenly believe that they're the Messiah. There's cases of like a Dallas housewife who this happened to, and it's like there's something, again, location-based that is just like emanating out from that place on the planet that is just like tuning these people into a frequency that is saying, you're the Messiah, the world's about to end. And I guess a cynic could say, well, yeah, Jesus was just probably suffering from the same delusions as that Dallas housewife. But, you know, the faithful would say, obviously, he stood out from the rest. So he was, there was something different about him.
No, I mean, that's exactly it. There's no question that Jesus lived in a society in which a lot of people were saying and doing the exact same thing that he was saying and doing. We have their information. We have their names. In some cases, we know more about them than we do even about Jesus, to be honest with you. But what is also unquestionable is that Jesus is the only one that we remember. And there is a reason for that. That there was something unique about his message. And what I try to do in Zealot is to explain what that thing was, what that unique thing was. And it may not be what I think most people think it is, but there is something there that made him different. And, you know, this conversation that, you know, I think we have in the modern world, right? You and I kind of started it when we were talking about that other Jesus with a Z, in Hawaii. And is he receiving messages from God, or is he crazy? And my answer is, what's the difference? I don't understand what the difference is, because forget about the fact that we still don't know exactly how the brain works. But I do think that there is something interesting in the sort of divide in this debate about, like, where religious epiphany comes from, right? And there's been a lot of cognitive scientists who have worked on this notion that, you know, we can sort of map the brain and we can sort of discover the chemical reactions that are involved in the creation of the religious impulse. And my answer is, so? Like, so what? I mean, what that means nothing. So just because the religious impulse is the result of chemical reactions in the brain doesn't delegitimize the religious impulse. Every impulse, every experience without exception, this conversation that you and I are having, the room that I am in, my conscious awareness of your existence, all of it is just a chemical reaction in my brain. So, you know, why would the religious experience be different? Why would there be something different, you know, in the way that it functions in the brain than every other experience would? To me, you don't have to pick one side or the other. You can just simply say, yeah, so, okay, so there it is. So is there something chemically going on in a man's brain to make him think that he's the Messiah? Maybe. Does that not make him the Messiah? I don't know.
That's the mystery. That's what's interesting. Yeah, I always say the only inexcusable position to take is being bored by anything, but just like this stuff in particular is like so interesting. And yeah, trying to take a materialist perspective and use that to debunk religious experiences is like trying to debunk a news story by dissecting the iPhone that it was read on and be like, well, that message can't be true because it was just this material and some electricity. And it's like, well, no, that's just how the message is transmitted, right?
Right, right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, we also know, by the way, we also know the chemical reactions involved in helping us experience love. So that, I guess that means that the people we love, it's just a fantasy, just imagination. It doesn't really actually exist because we know the chemical reactions involved in it. I mean, nobody would say that. Nobody would think that unless you're like, you know, a strict materialist. So, yeah, I mean, let's not be as secure in our positions as we tend to be.
I do want to ask you just on Scientology. I think most of what people know about that religion, or at least the people who I know about that religion, comes from an episode of South Park where they like showed all this stuff about a space plane and spirits coming out of a volcano. And is that stuff accurate? Is that what is in their sort of doctrine?
It is accurate. I mean, there is embedded in Scientology mythology, its lore, this concept of this intergalactic battle that took place, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago involving this alien villain named Sinu, and this notion that, you know, before there were any humans on Earth, these encased Phaetons, you know, were released into volcanoes, and, you know, their Satans were released and that, you know, they kind of interact with our bodies. Yeah, that is part of it. But here's the important thing. Number one, it's usually the only thing anyone knows about Scientology. It's like the only thing anyone knows about it. And number two, it is actually quite an insignificant aspect of Scientology. You know, I know that people are interested in it, so every Scientologist that I talk to, I would bring it up. Every time I meet somebody, I'd be like, so what is this whole Xenu thing? Can somebody help me with this?
Yeah.
And these are the responses I would get. About half would say, look, dude, it's just a metaphor. Like, you know, relax. You know, it's a story. It's a myth. You're supposed to think of it as a myth, you know, and like the way that you would think of any other myth, like the Adam and Eve story. In fact, one person even brought it up. They were like, I mean, do you really think there was an Adam and an Eve? No. It's a metaphor for, you know, God's creative role in the universe. But I also met Scientologists who were like, no, that actually happened. It's literally true. There was a Xenu. There was an intergalactic war that actually took place. In the same way that I know lots of people who would say, no, there was an Adam, and there was an Eve, and there was a Garden of Eden. That's not metaphor. That's literally true. That's literally what happened. But I think it's a reminder to all of us to realize, once again, that religion is experienced in many, many, many different ways. You know, which Christian is right? The Christian that says the Adam and Eve story is a metaphor, or the Christian that says the Adam and Eve story is literal? I don't know. I mean, who knows which one is right, right? But they probably think that each of them are right. The same thing is true with Scientology. I think, you know, some people think that that's a real, literal story that happened, and some people think, no, dude, that's just a metaphor. And which one of them is right? Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that the ones who say it's a metaphor, maybe I would just say that they have a more examined position, because I feel like people who just take the Bible at its word, I don't know. I do kind of have a problem with religious beliefs.
Literalism?
Literalism that negates the realities of science. That bothers me because
I'm 100% with you. At the same time, my criticism of literalist interpretations, not just of the Bible, but really of any religion, is that I think that most people misunderstand what the word myth even means, right? We confuse the word myth with falsehood. In fact, we use it all the time, right? Oh, that's a myth. What we mean is that's not true. But that's not what myth means. Myth, the dictionary definition of myth, is stories of gods and goddesses. That's a dictionary definition. And what I always try to remind people is that the truth of a myth is not involved in the facts of it, right? That the truth is much, much deeper than that. And so I'm with you in that, you know, I am a secular-minded, scientifically prone individual. And so, you know, I'm always going to take the side of the scientific argument over the non-scientific argument. But as a scholar of religions, I also feel like, you know, people need to understand that it's not just that their interpretation of a particular myth is, let's say, wanting. It's that they don't even understand what myth means. Like, they don't even get it. You know? I mean, here's something that's kind of interesting. What we now refer to as biblical literalism, this idea that the Bible is to be read literally and as inerrant, is a little bit more than 100 years old. I mean, isn't that extraordinary? The belief that the Bible should be read literally is actually the result of the Enlightenment and, more importantly, the scientific revolution, which essentially taught us that that which is true is that which can be factually verified, right? The scientific revolution transformed the definition of truth, what truth actually means. And essentially, it married the word truth to the word fact. That's what the scientific revolution did. And particularly religious Christians, conservatively religious Christians, when confronted with that reality, had two choices. The majority opinion, and this is mostly in the 18th and 19th centuries, the majority opinion was, well, the Bible then isn't true or factual in the way that we think it is, you know, that these stories are metaphors and we are to garner a different kind of truth from them. But the opposite reaction to that was, okay, if truth is only that which can be factually verified, then the only way the Bible can be true is if it can be factually verified. And so biblical literalism, the idea that the Bible should be read literally, arose out of that notion. But the people who wrote the Bible, the people who actually, you know, were the audience of the Bible, never in a million years thought that what they were reading was literally true or literally or factually happened. It would never have even occurred to them that that would have been a question. If you went up to somebody in Jesus' time and said, did Jonah get swallowed by an actual whale, they would look at you like you were from Mars. They would be like, I don't even understand the question. What are you talking about? Like, that's not the point of the story. What do you mean did he actually get swallowed by a whale? That doesn't make any sense. I don't understand the question. It's amazing that for us, in the modern world, we think that this is how people have always thought. They've always thought, you know, the Bible was to be read literally. No, not really, actually. That's a pretty new idea.
And isn't it true that a lot of the fundamentalist Islam beliefs are also a fairly recent movement?
Well, yes, because the Quran is not like the Bible. The Quran is not a bunch of stories, right, that you could choose to read literally or figuratively. The Quran is God's dramatic monologue. It's just page after page after page of God just talking. It's like God's soliloquy. That's basically what it is. So there's no, like, there's a few stories here and there, but there isn't, you know, this kind of conversation when it comes to the Quran isn't, should it be read literally or figuratively? The conversation about the Quran is usually divided between people who say that it should be read with no context whatsoever. So in other words, what was revealed 1,400 years ago is set in stone, and what applied 1,400 years ago needs to apply today. And those Muslims who say, well, no, I mean, of course not. Like, yes, it's a holy scripture, but we don't live in the world that we lived in 1,400 years ago, so of course you have to bring historical context into the interpretation. That's the primary dividing line in Islam. The primary dividing line in Christianity is it literal or figurative? And Islam is, should we apply context, historical context, to our interpretation, yes or no? When you look at these groups, these very, you know, so-called fundamentalist Muslim groups, what drives them is we need to revert to the world of 1,400 years ago. That's the world that the Quran was revealed in. That's the context in which we need to live our lives now, regardless of how different our community is from the original community. And as you can imagine, that necessarily can create an enormous amount of conflict with, like, what we expect from living in a contemporary world and sort of our modern ideas of human rights and relationships between men and women and, you know, the role of government and society. Like, none of that actually fit the world of 1,400 years ago.
And was the idea that we should revert back to that time period, was that prominent or as prominent as it is today in the early 1900s?
What really brought it out to the surface, I mean, these are conversations that, you know, theologians would have all the time. What made it what we know today as this fundamental divide in the Muslim world was colonialism. Because you have to understand that, you know, during the colonial period, 90% of the world's Muslim population lived under direct colonial rule. And colonialism wasn't just an economic enterprise, it was a civilizational enterprise. And it had as its goal, fundamental goal, the recreation of Muslim societies into Western societies. And a great many Muslims in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and, you know, really particularly in the twilight of the colonial experience leading up to the First and Second World Wars, bristled against that and said, we don't want to to live in a westernized society. We want to live in an Islamic society. And then, of course, the answer was, well, what is an Islamic society? Like, what does that even mean? You know, what is an Islamic state? And there, that's when the answer became this sort of dividing line, right? Where a great many people said, well, it just means a modern constitutional state, but one that is defined by, you know, Islamic mores and values, and one that is, you know, predicated on the rights and privileges of its Muslim majority citizens.
We had that whole golden age. Why don't we just go back to that idea?
Yeah, let's go, exactly. But of course, a far louder, smaller but louder contingent said, no, what it means is to go back to the original community that the Prophet Muhammad made 1,400 years ago. That's what it means. And then, of course, you know, the failure of colonialism, the collapse of the colonialist experience left behind throughout the Middle East and North Africa these failed states, right? These countries that were made-up countries, right? Countries that Winston Churchill just invented, you know, on his desk while smoking a cigar and drinking a brandy, you know? He just drew a line and was like, congratulations, you're Lebanon. Drew a line. Congratulations, you're now Syria. You know, like, these are just fake countries. They're fabricated nationalities that, you know, it may have worked when the Europeans were in charge of the day-to-day running of the countries, but once colonialism ended, what you had was this absolute collapse. And, as is often the case, there is a reason why so many of the countries, these post-colonialist countries of the Middle East and North Africa, are either military dictatorships, Syria, you know, Egypt, or fundamentalist theocracies like Saudi Arabia, right? Those are the two most powerful forms of identity that can just kind of take over a chaotic, collapsed state situation. It's not a coincidence.
Well, that's interesting. I feel like I could talk to you all day, but we are running out of time. Could you just maybe go into like what the kind of most surprising thing or the thing that you think would surprise our audience the most that you learned during the making of Believer?
I think what would probably come as a shock to most people, especially when you kind of watch these episodes of Believer, is how much we all have in common with each other, believers and non-believers alike. How, you know, people who are expressing their views through a religion that looks so weird and foreign and exotic to you, that looks so beyond anything that you are used to, how once you kind of break through, you know, the specific symbols, the specific metaphors that they use to express themselves, once you learn it, then you realize, huh, that's pretty much what I believe. That's pretty much what I think. It's just that I express it in a completely different way. You know, I've known this throughout my entire career as a scholar of the world's religions, and this is my attempt now to kind of make everyone else realize it.
Hey guys, we're listening to Else by Bilk Spill, which is a song that was, yeah, with me during some pretty important times in my life, thanks to my sister, used to burn CDs for me. She was just out visiting in LA, so I was just thinking about her, and these lyrics always seemed to border on the profound and spiritual. It's just one of my favorite songs that I've not had a chance to share with you guys yet. So I hope you enjoy it, and yeah, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. On to some brief footnotes. We are going to link off to the page for Believer, the new Reza Aslan show, as well as to Reza's book Zealot, which I got to finish reading and is a really, really great read. I highly recommend it. We'll link off to the viral video of Reza just owning an anchor from Fox News. And we'll link to two cracked articles, Ridiculous Things You Probably Believe About Islam and Myths You Probably Believe About Major Religions. And finally, we'll link to an article in The Telegraph called Jerusalem Syndrome, the madness that grips foreigners on the streets of the holy city. That is a fascinating read. And we're going to link off to where you can subscribe to Howl Premium. A lot of people have been asking me, where can I find the older episodes of the Cracked Podcast? And as of right now, you have to be a subscriber to Howl. So we're going to link off to the Howl subscription. That's where all our old podcasts live currently. So if you want to hear episodes that are older than, I think, 6 months, for the time being, you have to subscribe to Howl. And that's going to do it for us. Hope to see you at the live show. Thanks to engineer Brett for putting it together for us this week, as always. You can follow Brett at Brett, R-A-D-E-R, on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack_O-B-R-I-E-N. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then. Just
it has worked! Now, gentle listener, you are enraptured by the voice of Usador the Wizard, for I have cast a spell upon thee that shall force you to listen to the ad at the end of this podcast.
Thank you, Usador. We're here to let you know that you should listen to our podcast, Hello from the Magic Tavern, a serious study of what it's like to be trapped in another dimension, although you might just think it's an improv comedy podcast.
Sorry, I'm late, guys. Here we go. If you're going to lay down, you might as well lay down on Casper mattress.
No, we're not doing that right now. We've only got a couple seconds to let listeners know about our podcast, where I interview wizards, unicorns,
and goblins, and wedding planners.
If you love fantasy stuff, you'll love this podcast. If you hate fantasy stuff, who the f*** are you kidding? You're not cool. What are you listening to? Oh, I'm a comedy nerd. I'm a better than a fantasy nerd. Mm-mm.
And now you are released from my spell. Return to your life and listen there again to the end of a podcast.
Hello from the Magic Tavern. Listen from the beginning or just jump into the most recent episode. You'll get it. It's not The Wire.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.